What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
The following podcast is a Dear Media production.
Hi, I'm Dr. Will Cole, leading functional medicine expert and best-selling author. This podcast is the manifesto for a new breed of health seekers. This is The Art of Being Well. What is up, everyone? It's Dr. Will Cole, and welcome to The Art of Being Well. I am a leading functional medicine expert. I get to consult people around the world via webcam. I started one of the first functional medicine telehealth centers in the world over a decade ago, and I'm a New York Times bestselling author. I wrote Intuitive Fasting, Ketotarian, and The Inflammation Spectrum. If you want to learn more about my clinical work, the telehealth center, or the books, you can check it all out at drwillcole.com. That's drwillcole.com. All right, let's get to today's guest. He is so awesome. I've got to know him over the past few years. Amazing person. I've been on his podcast a few times, and now I'm so pumped that he's on The Art of Being Well. His name is Ethan Suplee. You may know Ethan Suplee from the many things he's done in film and television. He was in Mallrats, My Name is Earl. He was in American History X, such a great film, and he was so great in that movie. He was in Blow, Cold Mountain, another great movie. The Wolf of Wall Street, another great movie. Remember the Titans? Oh my gosh, he was great in that. And he was also, I'm such an 80s and 90s kid, he was Frankie in Boy Meets World. What the heck? Anyways, a few of my favorite things that we cover in this episode is Ethan's background in the entertainment industry, how he got into it, what it was like getting into it in the 90s, and all the amazing behind-the-scenes stuff that we learned through Ethan's career. We talk about what happened in Ethan's childhood that shaped the way he felt towards food specifically and his relationship with food. We talk about how being vulnerable helped Ethan take control of his health and his weight and addiction. We talk about how Ethan uses carbs and the changes to his carb intake that he makes throughout the day to stay healthy. We talk about the food prepping that Ethan does currently, very interesting, and what the biggest needle mover for Ethan is when it comes to his fitness and his health. And we talk about his amazing podcast, American Glutton. So good. All right, let's get to today's guest, my friend, Ethan Suplee. Ethan Suplee, how the heck are you doing, my friend?
Hey, Dr. Will Cole, how are you? I'm good.
I didn't realize before we started recording here that I was one of your first podcast guests. I'm honored. Thanks, man.
You were absolutely the first legit dude within this universe of like health and fitness and stuff. You were the very first. You were within the first, I think, three actual guests. Other than that, it was me talking about myself, me talking to old friends. And then I believe then there was you. You were the first dude.
Yeah, wow, I'm super honored about that. I did not know that. Happy to do it. And you have a great show. I mean, we'll talk all about it. You're doing some amazing stuff. I told you my team, super fans. I'm a super fan of what you're doing. We'll get into all of that. But I mean, speaking of that, something I wanted to tell you that I haven't had a chance to tell you is that you're very easy to talk to. Is like I'm on podcasts or I'm talking to patients, and then there's patients that are super easy to talk to and the patients that aren't very easy to talk to. There's just like an energy thing. But every time that I've talked to you, it's like this really easy thing to do. I have a really natural, authentic conversation. So I wanted to commend you on that. And maybe that's probably what makes you a great podcaster. And I'm assuming it probably served you well on film as well. Has anyone ever told you that before?
I have been told, or I was told early on, that like 90% of success in the entertainment industry is in the meeting, prior to anybody having some idea of what you're going to do in the project itself. It's so this idea that you're able to talk to people, and it's nothing I ever worked on, but I did have that in my head of like, how do you have a good meeting? And I always just came to the idea of being interested and trying to find things to be interested in, versus the idea of being interesting. So in a performance, obviously, there is some attention on being interesting. Mm-hmm. And then I just think it's the reverse. If you're trying to have a conversation with somebody who's trying to be interesting, you're not really having a conversation. You're watching a performance. So I do think it's two different things.
Yeah. No, very true. I mean, that having that curiosity and inquisitiveness is very important for what you do as far as podcasting is concerned. Let's kind of, if I could, where did you grow up, by the way? I was listening to video interviews of you, and where was it?
L.A.
Yeah, you grew all up in LA. LA. Yeah. So your grandparents were in Vermont?
My grandparents were in Vermont. I was born in New York, okay. But then we moved to LA when I was very young.
Okay. What part of LA did you grow up in?
The Valley.
Oh, okay.
But you're in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, I'm in Pittsburgh.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. My parents went to college there. They met in Pittsburgh.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. Very cool. So you've had, like when I was doing research for us talking today, an amazing career. Like the things that you've done, and I mean, I'm going to list off some of these. Seth Ryan in American History X, is that right?
Yeah.
Louis Lastic in Remember the Titans, which my whole team was like, yes, he's like amazing in that. And what I know, this is so like maybe not the coolest thing, but like I grew up watching you on Boy Meets World.
Yes.
I mean,
it's still a weird thing because I feel like I was in... I've done lots of stuff, but there was a very specific Boy Meets World audience, which I assume you're the right age to have been watching the first aired episodes, mid to late 90s. It was geared towards young kids, and it was like, thank TGIF and all of that. Yeah. And then there was the American History X crowd, which can be very diverse, but almost always very specific. And then there's Remember the Titans was a very universally loved movie. And, you know, Blow has a real specific group that's into it. Mm-hmm. But it would be weird because I would often see somebody have a spark of recognition and I would play a game of like, I wonder what they know me from. Is that a Boy Meets World person or is that an American History X person? You know,
I'm a Boy Meets World person. I don't know what that says about me. But I mean, you were when you were going through this, I mean, as like an 80s and 90s kid myself, being on the other side, like being on the silver screen and going and doing all this, did you realize the cultural impact that you would have done? Even, I mean, later on with the other, many other films that you've done, as the actor, do you realize that this is going to be an indelible mark in people's minds?
The only thing I really thought that with, you know, no, to put it to you, fairly. The first movie I ever did was a movie called Mallrats. And the director, Kevin Smith, had such massive success with a little teeny tiny indie movie, which he, you know, shot for $30,000, which then made millions and millions of dollars. So it was this huge success. So his follow-up movie, Mallrats, which was made for $6 million, we all expected like, well, there should be a progression. This movie's going to make $100 million. Our careers are set. We're on easy street. I don't even think it made it to the second week in movie theaters. It did so poorly. So very quickly, I realized we have no control ultimately over how successful something we does, how it's received. Mm-hmm. And whether I think what we're doing is good at the time or not, it goes through many processes before you wind up seeing it. It's they pick a take and maybe that's not the take you like, and then it's mm-hmm. edited, and then there's music put over it and all of these things. I have no power over the final product. So I have utterly given up on going like, this is going to be good. So when American History X had some success, that was really cool because I thought that was a culturally important movie. And then the same thing with Remember the Titans. Remember the Titans might be the most successful movie I was in. And I thought there was like real important stuff in there. So it was mm-hmm. nice that those movies were the ones that were super successful.
Mm-hmm. That's really fascinating. I mean, over your career, which you've been doing this for a long time now, how has the industry changed from the beginning till now? I mean, is there any considerable things you're like, well, this is a different industry? Is it pretty much the same?
2020, it's mm-hmm. changed dramatically. I did a movie in 2020, which was super weird, the experience, because, you know, I was getting COVID tested daily. And mm-hmm. and then I did a video game, which was even weirder because it was walking into a room with cameras set up and being told via Zoom, like we're doing, what to do, because mm-hmm. they didn't want any human interaction. So that was like super weird. I think the biggest changes have all been technology based, mm-hmm. just in that, like when I started in the early 90s, I had to have a photograph, a headshot of myself, a tangible thing to give to somebody, an actual resume on paper to give to somebody. I would pick up scripts and have to read them. Mm-hmm. And even on Boy Meets World, where they would do rewrites every night, I would wake up to a script slipped under my door. So there was a dude who would drive the script to my house after they'd rewritten it. And he would do that to everybody, all the cast and the director and all the main people who have to like organize, you know, like the head of the camera department, the head of lighting. That obviously it's all just, you know, they don't even like to print stuff now. So you're getting mm-hmm. stuff on in Kindle form. I don't think that's true, but like PDF scripts and mm-hmm. And I haven't had a actual tangible picture of myself other than things that people send to me to sign for them. But like, I don't own a picture of myself. Mm-hmm. So that kind of stuff is weird. Like I wouldn't know how to suggest somebody begin acting now, because I think that that landscape is so different. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, there's been ebbs and flows. Like when I started out, you know, there was a real kind of knock against television, and that's what I started doing. And then the mm-hmm. minute I kind of got into movies, it was like, well, I'm done with television. You don't do television. Mm. And then, you know, television got cool again. And then there was like the rise of indie movies. And then, and now I think we're back to those lines are totally muddied. And like, clearly, for me, there's better content on TV mm-hmm. than there is certainly this year. Cause I mean, I haven't been to a movie in over a year now. Mm-hmm. So there's no content in theaters for me at all, but mm-hmm. it's gone from the more kind of indie stylized stuff has been even broadened and made into series versus what we get in movie theaters, which is predominantly, you know, big action mm-hmm. stuff, which mm-hmm. I like. It's fun to watch. But mm-hmm. if you want to like get really emotionally involved in something, you kind of have to go to TV now.
Yeah, it is interesting, right? I even look like as an outsider from the health space, like seeing my friends in the industry, seeing you like do this stuff and social media and how that has to be different too, of like how you relate to people that watch your stuff, your fans. I mean, when you started seeing that transition of how people in Hollywood related with their fans, what was that experience like?
That was super weird too. I felt like I got on Twitter late, but it was like 2009 or 10, and I was mm-hmm. still somehow late to the party.
Yeah.
And I made almost everything I talked about on Twitter was jokes about my kids, just like, you know, sharing my life in one sentence or two sentence quips about raising kids and what it's like being a dad. That was how I used Twitter. And then there was like a shift where what you were saying started to mean something in the real world outside of your experience. And it kind of got to be like heavy and a drag. And so I just didn't really participate anymore, because the idea that, you know, and we could talk about this, because there's a lot of tumult in the industry, and maybe almost all on Twitter. So I don't know how real it is, but with the idea of marginalizing a group in real life because you're giving an actor who is not a member of that group the opportunity to play a member of that group. And so, you know, and there are extremes where I go, like, there's one side where, you know, you want to have trans actors have the opportunity to have careers in the industry, right?
Yeah.
So that's a very real thing. You want to give deaf actors and otherwise abled actors, I don't know the proper terminology, but like people who you want to give them opportunities. I look at Peanut Butter Falcon with Shia LaBeouf, and I thought it was one of my favorite movies. I believe it was last year. It might have even been the year before, but that, I thought that movie was spectacular. If you cast anybody else in that, in the lead role of the kid,
yeah,
it's not as good. So thank God that kid got to play that part. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
At the same time, like, I loved What's Eating Gilbert Grape. So I'm not going to knock What's Eating Gilbert Grape because, you know, Leo didn't have whatever affliction he was performing. It goes back and forth. At some point, we come to the conclusion, or that on the other side of the spectrum, that, like, you can't play a murderer unless you're a murderer. Now, I understand murderers are not a marginalized group, but the whole point of acting is pretending. The whole point is, it's all BS, you know, you're every bit of it is made up. And like, some of my favorite parts of being an actor have been investigating what I'm playing and learning about it. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
I learned to play the banjo. I'm not a banjo player. And I understand that banjo players are not really a marginalized group for essentialistic reasons, in the way that we would talk about somebody who's trans or of a marginalized ethnicity. So it just becomes this complicated thing. That is an interesting change.
Yeah.
Because I certainly want everybody to have opportunity to have a place in the industry. But it does become weird when, like, I read about Scarlett Johansson backing out of a movie, and then I go, like, well, the unfortunate thing is now they're just not going to make that movie. It's not that they're going to, that she's going to back out and a trans person is going to come in. This story that I think would have the potential to make trans people more real to the groups that are not having interaction with them, which is the, who we need to kind of see these as real people. Like, to me, I think that's the important thing. Like, see human beings as human beings and have more empathy and acceptance for people. Like, we do a disservice by not having these movies get made because there's no big star that can, you know, at the end of the day, despite how much we want these big corporations to be altruistic, they're not. They're going to behave superficially altruistic, but at the end of the day, they're all in it to make money. So if they're going to, they're going to make these decisions based on how much money they think they're going to make. And if they think that their movie's going to suffer because there's a group of people on Twitter saying that Scarlett Johansson shouldn't play that part, then maybe they pull the movie. But they're not pulling the movie because they agree with you morally. They're pulling the movie because they're afraid of a financial backlash. So I don't know. It's a very confusing thing. But I still think that there is a lot of, like, really great stuff being made, you know? Sorry, that was a long rant and a half.
I appreciate it. I mean, it's to hear that insider view of somebody that's seen the industry evolve over since the 90s and this cancel culture that's here that obviously has some good has come out of it, but I've seen lots of unintended consequences of, like you're saying, like a lost opportunity of educating people that need educated about a certain topic. Today's program is brought to you by Athletic Greens, the most comprehensive daily nutritional beverage. With so many stressors in life, it's difficult to maintain effective nutritional habits and give our bodies the nutrients it actually needs to feel great and thrive. Our busy schedules, maybe some of us have poor sleep, exercise, the environment, stress, or simply just not eating enough of the right foods can leave us deficient in key nutrients. This is where Athletic Greens can help. It is a life-changing nutritional habit. Their daily all-in-one superfood powder is your nutritional essential. It is by far the easiest and the most delicious nutritional habit you can add to your daily routine today and empower towards better habits from here on out for the rest of your life. They simplify the logistics of getting optimal nutrition on a daily basis by giving you one thing with all the best things. I love it because it's so easy and I'm busy consulting patients 10 plus hours a day. Just one scoop of Athletic Greens has so many nutrients. It actually contains over 75 vitamins, minerals, and whole food source ingredients, including a multivitamin, multimineral, probiotic, a green superfood blend, and more that all work together to fill the nutritional gaps in your diet, increasing your energy, increasing your focus, aiding with gut health, digestion, and supports a healthy immune system, all without the need to take multiple products or pills. And go above and beyond in third-party testing to ensure their customers continue to receive the highest quality and best daily nutritional habit on the planet. It's lifestyle-friendly, whether you eat keto, paleo, vegan, dairy-free, or gluten-free, and contains less than 1 gram of sugar without compromising on taste. And right now, Athletic Greens is offering my audience a free 1 year supply of vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase if you visit my link today. Simply visit athleticgreens.com/Will Cole. That's athleticgreens.com/Will Cole. And join health experts like me, athletes, and health conscious go-getters around the world who make a daily commitment to their health every day. Again, simply visit athleticgreens.com/Will Cole and get your free year supply of vitamin D and 5 free travel packs today.
What's up, family? We are Terrell and Jarius, the host of Let's Go There, where we will, in fact, go there every single week.
Every Wednesday in this podcast, no topics are off limits for us. We will be pushing ourselves and you to see different perspectives, challenging what you think you know, and have fun all at the same time.
So listen, I want you guys to go ahead and buckle up because going there is going to be the ride of your life.
See you guys next week.
So if I could go back to something that I touched on at the top of the conversation is when you were 5 years old, I've heard you talk about this and going to visit your grandparents in Vermont and this sort of pivotal point where you're 5 years old and we're both parents. We know there's a lot of innocence at that age.
Sure.
And something happened then that made you realize something about you. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I had no awareness. I mean, this is like you turn on a light in a very dark room and suddenly you're seeing stuff. So in my awareness, there was no thought about food beyond stuff I liked and stuff I didn't like. And looking forward to going to my grandfather's house because I knew he would make lasagna, which was something I really enjoyed eating. So that was like as far into food as I got. And I, to be really honest and fair to my grandparents, I have no idea because I never asked, and I probably should, if my parents had a conversation with them, like he's put on some weight, maybe he could diet while he's at your house. I don't know if that happened, but I arrived in Vermont to my grandparents and they were aghast at how, you know, I'd let myself go basically was the idea. Now, 5 years old in 1980, I was not obese. I was a chubby five-year-old kid. And I say chubby, I was on the, you know, nowadays, you might not even think twice that I was a chubby kid at five. Mm-hmm. And you know, I was made to take my clothes off and get on a scale, and my body was examined and discussed. And then I was basically put on a restrictive diet. Mm-hmm. And I was made to weigh myself, or I was made to weigh every day. And it was talked about with horror. I have no idea what the numbers were. But that was the moment where I was aware that something was wrong with me, and that this force, this kind of authoritative force, was going to use their power to deny food to me. And so it very quickly just became, then I was also forced to walk with them. And at five in Vermont, I love nothing more than running around outside and visiting the neighbors who all lived on farms, and going on my own kind of adventure walks in the forest and making up stories and all of this. So it had the total opposite effect. I now, at that moment, knew that if I wanted to eat what I wanted, I was going to have to do it sneakily and in private, and in a way that they weren't aware of. So I remember the very first meal when I went to get more lasagna, and I was told, like, you know, my hand was swatted away, and I was told, no, you've had your fill. That I was like, okay, I'll clear the plates. I cleared the plates, and taking them in, I was just eating food off their plates very quickly, you know, in the kitchen when they couldn't see it. And the forced marches in the morning, after that, I was just like, well, now I'm not going to do anything. You made me do that. And now I'm just going to do the opposite of what you want. So I'm going to sit here and watch TV as like an act of rebellion or something. And it long-term created really bad habits for me. And look, this is my memory of it. These people are no longer alive. They could have a totally different memory, and they could, I don't think they were being malicious. They looked at me and they went, he's overweight. His parents are irresponsible. We're going to put him on a diet. We're going to get him active. Mm-hmm. And so I think their intentions were really good.
Right.
It just wound up making me, I was also like a bit of a prick as a kid. So I was, I was just like, you're going to tell me I have to clean my room? Okay, I'm going to make it messier. You know, that was kind of my attitude.
Right.
I still don't do well with anything being forced on me. So there were a lot of bad habits that were kind of, that I was participated in installing in myself. Mm-hmm. When I got home, my mom continued this diet, which I cheated on as vigorously as possible. And then I would be rewarded on Saturdays with a trip through the drive-thru. And so I had this simultaneous overeating, binge eating, compulsive eating. And it was almost like nobody's looking. Okay, I can smash this food in my mouth and swallow it. And then what they thought, I was sticking to this diet. So then I was rewarded with food. It was really, a recipe for disaster.
Right. And like you said, our parents' generation, our grandparents' generation, they did the best they could. Most of them did with the information they had. They had good intentions, but it's such a truth, like, where you can't, for the most part, it doesn't work long-term to shame somebody into wellness or feel like you can force them, especially as a kid. Do you feel like what effect that had if they wouldn't have made a big deal about it? I mean, I guess it's wandered water under the bridge. You can't change that, but it had to have played a major part for a long part of your life, of your relationship with food and your relationship with your body, right?
I mean, that was five. I'm about to be 45, so 40 years, and I've only really started to feel good and comfortable and have the feeling of compulsion, the feeling of anxiety, and whether that's a manic anxiety or a depressive anxiety, that's subsided just in the last 2 years, and I'm still working at it. So, and I've been dieting steadily since 2002. There has been no long period of me not on a diet since 2002. And just in the last year and a half, 2 years, I've started to feel like I've got stuff under control. And it is an amazing feeling, but I'm also a sober person. So I'm constantly checking that feeling because I never want to be so comfortable that I am kind of aloof to my history. Mm-hmm. Do you know if that makes sense? I don't want to be this kind of dry drunk where I'm just white knuckling through the pain. I don't think that was healthy for me, which I did for a long time.
Right.
And you know, I gotta be honest. I hate the word mindfulness. I hate it. However, it's a dead on accurate word for kind of thinking about what I'm eating, being aware of how I feel when I'm eating it. And I wish it wasn't an accurate word, or I wish it didn't have this hippie connotation, or I wish the hippies didn't have some weird connotation for me.
Yeah.
But like, you know, when I'm working on a maintenance period on my kind of cyclical cutting fat and building muscle and then maintaining my body weight, and I'm setting out a meal and I'm not watching TV because I can pound through the meal and be ready for more without thinking if I'm doing something else while I'm eating, and I'm aware of it, and I'm like paying attention to what my body's saying, you know, all these physical indicators that I steamrolled over by binge eating and compulsive eating and doing something so quickly out of sight that I was never kind of in tune with how I felt while I was doing it. It was just like, get it in, swallow it. Did anybody see me? Nope. Good. We're safe. Move on with your day. You know?
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a weird, really nice place that I've come to, but it took a lot of work.
Right. And this is fascinating to me. It's like you then got into acting and you said at the highest, what was your highest weight? Around 500?
The highest I ever was, I was in rehab, and they had this rule about when you're doing intake at rehab, you have to be weighed, like whatever. And there was no scale that could weigh me. So we had to go to a shipping center in Oklahoma, and I had to get on a shipping scale, a freight scale, and I was 536.
Wow.
I will tell you that I gained weight for sure in rehab, and then continued to gain weight out of rehab. So I was for sure heavier than 536, but the highest objective metric I had to put a number on it was 536. So I say 550 because I know I was probably even a bit over that.
Wow. What year was that, Ethan?
2001. No, 2000.
2000. Around, you know, before that, or just around a large part of your career, you owned that type of role, the big guy, and it was like your moneymaker in a way. You was your what you were known for. So did that incentivize in some way? Like, okay, I need to keep, like, losing weight could hurt my career. Is that a thing or no?
No. I mean, listen, season one of Boy Meets World, I was a big guy. It was like 1994, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I'm doing Boy Meets World. And the producers at some point towards the end of the season said to my agents, you know, he doesn't have to gain weight. Tell him he doesn't have to gain weight.
Mm.
And my agents then called me and said, they say you don't have to gain weight. And I was like, what do you mean? I didn't gain weight. And my agent said, well, I think you did. And they're saying you don't have to. I don't think they could say, tell him to stop gaining weight, but they were, you know, but it was like a polite way of saying that, I guess. So there was almost immediately some concern expressed for how big I was and that I was getting bigger. And so when I finally decided to lose weight and it was my decision and my determination, I just thought, you know, like even if I'm 300 pounds, I'm still the big guy, you know? Mm-hmm. And that was kind of what I was thinking with. I don't think in the beginning I ever imagined myself looking the way I do now. That took me a long time to even have that as like a potential in my mind. So, you know, I wasn't really thinking about my career. It was more just like, damn, 500 plus pounds is too much. Mm-hmm. I can't spend a day with my girlfriend at the time mm-hmm. walking around. You know, she wants to go to Europe and walk around all day for a week. I can't do that. That's not possible. But I could at 300 pounds, you know?
Mm-hmm. So was there a moment, I mean, was it at that time when they weighed you at 530? Was it at a rehab? Was there this pivotal aha moment where it's like it clicked and there was no looking back? Or, because I know you've tried every diet under the sun throughout this time too. So tell me about that. Was it one cataclysmic thing or was it just a gradual evolution?
It was a combination of a weird conversation I had with Jim Caviezel on a plane. We were flying to Germany and he was talking about how he lived and how he tried to emulate Christ in his life and was expressing real concern for my soul, which made me incredibly uncomfortable. Again, he was coming from a very good place. Mm-hmm. It was kind of that followed by a conversation with my girlfriend, who is now my wife, and we have a ton of kids. and it's great, and thank God for her.
Four girls, right? And,
yeah, four girls.
That's sweet.
And so I got off the plane and was like really traumatized. Had never had a conversation like that with somebody. Not mad at him, but more just like, I don't want to be in this position. And then I was also thinking about my future with her because I had had girlfriends before and I never thought about the future. I was not a guy who thought about the future. It was mm-hmm. always just like, what are we doing tonight? What drugs are we doing? What fast food am I getting after mm-hmm. I drop you off? If you're going to come over to my house, are you going to fall asleep? And then I'm going to go sneak out and get fast food. Like I just lived in this moment to moment thing. And with this girl, I suddenly was thinking about like, you know, the future for the first time, really. And mm-hmm. so having the conversation with her, it's the weirdest thing because I am objectively over 500 pounds. This is not a mental disorder. This is a physical truth. Mm-hmm. And yet having the conversation with her, it was almost as though I was telling her a secret. I was opening this door to this secret that I had never told anyone. And it had nothing to do with, like, I didn't say to her, you know, I'm 500 pounds. Mm-hmm. It was just like, asking her for help felt like that, you know.
Yeah, being vulnerable.
It was the most vulnerable I've ever been because I felt like the minute I ask her for help, if I fail, we're done. And I'm asking her for help only because I want to succeed with her and have a life with her. And so that was the most risky thing, but also the only thing I could do. There's no way she stays with me. There's no way I'm alive today mm-hmm. if I remained at that weight. You know, I think my sobriety was in jeopardy remaining it that way. It was just like a lot of bad news. And so, you know, she's not a nutritionist. She doesn't know really what she's doing, but she had a friend who was a nutritionist and she said, he can help you and we're going to do this program and I'm going to be the person who holds your hand as you take your first step.
Wow.
And at some point you're going to figure out something else, because the program I started was not something you could do forever. You starve to death if you try to do that, you know?
Mm-hmm. Wow, I didn't know all that stuff. So that conversation that you had on the plane about God and Jesus and your soul and that relationship you had with your then girlfriend, was that around the same time then?
It was literally, we were on a flight to Frankfurt and then I was going to Romania and he was going somewhere else. And so there was like a few hours before I landed in Romania and I got to my hotel and I really was like, what do I do? And then I called her. So it was like within that day that I had this conversation with Jim and then I was thinking about her and then I had the conversation with her and she actually, I mean, it was pretty funny because it then became such a ritual for me in dieting, but her first thing was like, okay, I'm going to have something ready for you when you hit the ground in Los Angeles, mm-hmm. you know, two weeks from now. But until then, here's what you're going to do. No sugar, no bread. And I was like, Okay, that's it. Okay, so there was like this weird no sugar, no bread. I'm in Romania. There's really not a lot of choices. You know, it was a really, really not long after they you know, the crowds kind of killed Ceausescu in the public square, and like it fell from, it was the last country to fall from communism. And so, I mean, I'm talking like 3 or 4 years after this happened, McDonald's was a fancy restaurant in Bucharest at the time. And so I was just like, okay, no, I can figure this out. And I did. And then I hit the ground in Los Angeles. I had a break from this movie and I started this program that she had, like, she literally handed me a box and had written out instructions and was like, at the airport, this is what you're doing. And I said, thank God. And I started.
According to the World Health Organization, as much as 75% of the U.S. adult population does not meet its daily magnesium needs. Magnesium supports over 300 essential functions in the human body. It regulates our mood, our brain function, fatigue, nerve and muscle health, as well as our physical response to stress. What I really love to support my magnesium levels in my body is Mellow from my friends at Ned. Mellow is specifically formulated to replenish and optimize your body's magnesium levels at a cellular level, simply and naturally. Magnesium is so freaking important for our mind, for our body, and our mood. And I love Mellow to get my magnesium levels in check. Mellow is a powerful daily magnesium supplement supercharged with L-theanine, GABA, and over 70 trace minerals, like raw materials for your brain and your mood and energy levels. It's crafted from a proprietary blend of three of the most bioavailable or usable forms of magnesium, including the only type shown to cross the blood-brain barrier, i.e., your brain freaking loves this type of magnesium. Mellow provides essential daily support to your mind, body, and mood. It supports your mind because it boosts memory and brain function, your body because it supports nerve and muscle health, restful sleep and regularity, and mood. It promotes calmness and a healthy stress response. And my friends at Ned are offering us 15% off your first one-time purchase or 20% off your first subscription order. All you have to do is use code Will Cole for 15% off your first one-time purchase or 20% off your first subscription order. So again, code Will Cole at checkout for this amazing deal. Just go to helloned.com/Will Cole. Again, that's helloned.com/Will Cole. helloned.com/Will Cole and use code Will Cole at checkout for that 15% off your one-time purchase or 20% off your first subscription order. Digestive problems are so common. When I'm consulting people from my functional medicine telehealth center, I would say gut health or digestive symptoms are one of the top things that I see. And they're so common that many people believe they're just a normal part of life. As I say, ad nauseum, is just because something's common doesn't necessarily mean it's normal. And remember, 70 to 80% of your immune system is living in your gut. So any stomach disruption could mean it's not just a digestive problem, it could cause systemic immune and inflammatory problems throughout the body. So feeling your best requires that you have as much good bacteria living in your gut as possible. And unfortunately, it doesn't take much to deplete your good microbiome bugs, your gut garden, if you will. Stress can deplete it and impact the balance of the microbiome. Just one round of antibiotics can mess up the microbiome negatively. Poor food choices, exposure to chemicals like glyphosate, or a viral infection can all do a number on disrupting the beautiful balance of the gut microbiome. That's why I'm such a big fan of Just Thrive Probiotic. I recently had Just Thrive's founder and microbiologist on the podcast. You need to check out that episode if you haven't. It's so like filled with microbiome truth bombs. You had to check that out. They're a wealth of knowledge in all things gut health. So make sure, please, to check out that episode. Just Thrive Probiotic is vastly different because of one word: survivability. See, most probiotics die well before they ever get to your gut. Even the supposedly special probiotics in the refrigerated section are oftentimes dead on arrival. This makes sense. If a probiotic can't survive at room temperature, how the heck can it possibly survive to your 98.6 degree body temp? Just Thrive Probiotic is different because their proprietary strains are designed to survive. When they sense that conditions are about to get rough, they put up a natural endospore shell, which acts like an impenetrable coating. Pretty cool, right? This allows the strains to pass through your stomach acid that's strong enough to dissolve metal and endure the bile and enzymes of your digestive tract, which pulverize most travelers on contact. That's the power of your stomach acid. You want to make sure that something can endure that to arrive fully intact in your intestines and get ready to work to support your gut health. Personally, I've added Just Thrive Probiotic to my daily routine, and I really love it. It's so awesome. I love that it's vegan-friendly, non-GMO, gluten, dairy, soy, sugar, and histamine-free. So people that have histamine intolerances, this is a good probiotic to consider. For exceptional gut and immune support, there's nothing like Just Thrive Probiotic. To get 15% off your order today, go to justthrivehealth.com. Again, that's justthrivehealth.com, and use promo code Will Cole at checkout. Again, that's justthrivehealth.com and use promo code Will Cole at checkout. To go back to that conversation again, that I find fascinating. Like I understand that you love this girl and you wanted to be there with her for a long time and get your life in order. But the conversation about like spirituality, God on the plane, what was that? Was it just that someone else saw you as needing help? That was like a aha moment, or what was it specifically about that conversation?
It's a weird, tricky thing when I rationalize it, because I utterly respect his conviction for having it, his integrity and his, yeah, I'm sure he looked at me and saw a guy in spiritual crisis or whatever, and was like, I'm going to help him. And here's how I know how to help him. For me, experiencing it, it was truly painful, but it also instigated a whole other host of things that led me on this path. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a fun conversation. It would be a really, it's something I would never do, because I really do believe, and through a lot of experience in trying to talk to people and say, I think you need help, I've found that doesn't always work until the person themselves decides they need help. Now, mm-hmm. It was a weird miracle and a confluence of events that his conversation with me happened right when I had this girl who I was in love with, who I wanted to have a future with, and I was looking at the world a little bit differently. If he had had that conversation with me and I hadn't met this girl and I hadn't mm-hmm. been seeing her, I don't know that it would have been useful. It would have just mm-hmm. made me resent him or something, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hear you.
Yeah.
So since that point, for people that don't know, you lost a ton of weight, and I have written down here that you lost and gained and lost again over 500 pounds. But kind of tell everybody about that. Like you had that sort of pivotal moment, then it was this journey from that point. What did that look like, and where are you at now health-wise?
I initially did, the first thing I did that my wife had set up for me was a liquid diet, and it was, you know, 600 calories a day and handfuls of fiber and mm-hmm. some vitamins. And I did that for 2 months and I lost 80 pounds. Those 80 pounds, I never gained back. Hmm. I have never again weighed what I weighed from 550 to 460. Mm-hmm. Actually, 480 was like the first time there was a scale that I didn't have to go to some crazy place. There was a doctor's office with a scale that went up to 500. And I remember the first time I could get on it and see like, hey, I'm yeah. below 500. This is a big deal.
Yeah.
And I don't know how accurate this was, but I had a scale where at 300, the needle would just swing back around and I would just add whatever it was to 300. So if I went you know, to 150, I would assume I was 450.
Got it.
I don't know if that, you know, but it was a metric and it was moving in the right direction.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it was kind of just like a real crapshoot after that of like, I guess the issue, you know, by the way, at 10, I was put on something called OptiFast, which was all shakes too. I don't know if that exists anymore. Mm-hmm. And I really didn't hate doing that because I was just eating nothing and I was losing. I remember losing weight a lot, but then there was something like, hey, he's actually too young. Cause I was doing it in consultation with a doctor and the doctor was finally like, he's a little too young for this. We're going to take him off. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of like, the only thing I have to be responsible for is these two shakes and handful of fiber. That was easy. Eating was much, much harder. And also my energy level, I couldn't work and do that diet. Like it was like, you know, every time I'd stand up, I'd have to steady myself. My vision would go almost to blackness and then come back. And like, that's not ideal. My energy was not great and I had to go back to work. And so, you know, I did the blood type diet and South Beach diet, Fit for Life. Like there wasn't a real, if there was a diet book out that made the New York Times bestseller list, I had it and I did it. And the one where I had the most success with, I say, because I was on it for the kind of the longest period of time. And in that I lost weight was keto. Mm-hmm. But again, you know, I remember reading Tim Ferriss's book and doing his diet. And he says, you have a cheat day. And the cheat day for me would always wipe out the week of effort that I put into the diet.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. So when I did keto, there would be long periods of time where it wasn't about like the tenets of the diet so much as if it's not a carbohydrate, it's fair game. Mm-hmm. If it's fat or mostly fat with protein. So we had all the pork rinds. I had would eat hot dogs, processed cheese, which even that I was aware, well, this has a little carbs. I'm not going to eat that much. And then I'd eat a pound of cheese and have to confront, like, I've just taken myself out of keto somehow. you know, I could gain weight doing keto. There was a place, eventually I was at a gym and it was next to a Whole Foods, and Whole Foods had a breakfast bar and they would just have a rack of bacon. And I would just fill a container with bacon and that would be a meal. I mean, like a pound of cooked bacon, you know, doing it that way, I would gain weight. And, you know, if I was going to the movies and getting multiple hot dogs and nacho cheese dip and taking them off the buns, that's how I ate for some time periods. And when I would get really focused and go, I'm not losing weight, I'm gaining weight. So I got to do something else. And then I would go to, you know, chicken thighs, you know, confit in olive oil and a couple sprigs of broccoli. And that would be my, and then some weight would come off, but eventually I stalled. And when I stalled, and this is like after doing this for a couple of years, I then started reducing my food to the point where I was basically hungry. And then I'd lose weight again. And I didn't ever think about like, you know, the amount I'm eating versus the energy my body needs for the day.
Right.
And so at some point I saw a TED talk where a guy was like, stop thinking about food as good or bad. What does your body need? And I just started like calculating everything and I wasn't hungry and I was having better results in the gym. I was stronger and I was losing weight, but I was also losing weight really slowly, which I had to become okay with. Like, these are the things I've honestly spent the most time like really working on is my need for any result to happen immediately. It's not going to be immediate. Whatever my my long-term goal is. It's a long-term goal. My mm-hmm. goal for today is make it through today and mm-hmm. make sure I have the tools I need to make it through today. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to get to my long-term goal today. I'm not going to get to my long-term goal next week or next month. Like, I've really settled myself down. Now, I completely recognize that if I went from 250 today and woke up at 550 tomorrow, I would be like, holy F-bomb,
yeah.
this has to come off and I need it off immediately. So I can understand that. But if I spent 10 years accumulating 300 pounds of excess fat, then I might have to confront the fact that it should, that's not, definitely is not going to have to take me 10 years to take it off, mm-hmm. but it's not going to happen in 6 months, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, just kind of settling that down has been really yeah. helpful.
Great. Yeah. So you had this journey and you evolved your relationship with food and the tool. You mentioned keto and that dirty keto. And we talked about this on your show before, but now you saw that TED Talk, I think it was, right? It was a TED Talk. What yeah. was the TED Talk for people that want to know?
Mike Isretel, and it was the landscape of healthy eating, something like that.
Okay.
The scientific landscape of healthy eating.
Okay. So that was all about energy expenditure, right? And like caloric intake. And so at that point, and even now, are you tracking calories? Are you tracking macros? Do you look at that?
Only thing I look at, honestly, is carbohydrates. The only thing I play with right now is mm-hmm. carbohydrates. If I'm going into a maintenance phase, I slowly increase my carbs. Mm-hmm. And if I'm going into a cutting phase, I slowly decrease my carbs. But other than that, I'm not really tracking. And it all comes from maintenance, where the amount of protein I need to maintain my muscle mass, I just got it dialed in. I mean, it's not, mm-hmm. it's not ounces or grams or this many things. Mm-hmm. It's not counted that way anymore. I look at it as like, you know, a piece of chicken about this big mm-hmm. with no skin on it for me. That's my protein serving. Mm-hmm. If I'm going to get beef, it's going to be lean beef. If I don't really eat pork, so I wouldn't say pork, but if it's mm-hmm. going to be fish, it's going to be about that big. Mm-hmm. I eat that 4 or 5 times a day. Mm-hmm. I eat a handful of veggies 4 or 5 times a day. I get some oil from, you know, olive oil is mm-hmm. what I tend to eat. Or I love avocado. If mm-hmm. I'm going to substitute half of an avocado for my mm-hmm. olive oil, or, and the only thing that I play with at all is carbs. And I only play with it if I'm changing what I'm doing. And yeah. so like a day like today, nothing is counted. Mm. Nothing is, it's all kind of like what I know from spending almost all year mm-hmm. on maintenance.
Right. So you're like, when you are trying to limit carbs or cut for a period of time, what are the typical grams, or do you not measure that either? You just ballpark it by this point.
No, by this point, I mean, if I change it, I'll start measuring it, but I get like a cup of rice, a mm-hmm. cup of cooked rice, or a sweet potato or a baked potato with each meal.
Okay.
So I can have four of those a day. Mm-hmm. I don't really eat a lot of other carbs. Now, if I'm deep into a cut and I'm having cravings, I'll get a loaf of diet bread and start mm-hmm. making myself sandwiches just to have mm-hmm. some feeling of like, this is fun and this is different.
Yeah.
But I can go months eating sweet potatoes, or months eating white rice, or mm-hmm. months eating baked potatoes. I can fill my fridge with a bin of sweet potatoes, and then that's my carb source, you know?
Yeah. That's awesome. And I was watching a video of you with this coveted bread that's on your side of the yeah. fridge. So what makes this bread so freaking good? I want to try it.
Okay. The thing that makes, you're not going to like it. You're going to, by the way, I've had so many friends who have gotten this bread and looked at the ingredients and their eyes have popped out of their heads and they've been like, this is poison. But that said, what makes the bread so good is it's 40 calories a slice. It's like, I mean, 40 calories a slice. What is that? That's like a, a third of a tablespoon of olive oil or something that. You know, it's like a non thing.
Yeah. Got it. So what's the name of it? It was like a
Schmidt's old timey 647 bread. And I think 647 stands for 6 grams of protein, 40 calories, 7 grams of carbs. I don't know. The 647 is something nutritional.
Okay, got it.
40 grams, 40 calories for me. I'm just like, I can eat a loaf today and I'm not going to gain weight.
Yeah. Have you tried the keto breads out there? I mean, obviously, they're not calorically, they're higher, but I just wondered what your thoughts are on that.
I'm so early on keto, the first iteration of kind of, I predate keto, I think, with. It was the first time the idea of not eating bread was brought up to me was like something about gluten. There was like a gluten frenzy in Los Angeles and it was like, gluten is bad, get away from it. And so
I may have been part of that gluten frenzy.
Possibly. I was all in. I was like, okay, gluten is bad. Yeah. You know, unfortunately I went to Asia not long after the gluten frenzy started here and they had on menus just dishes of gluten.
Yeah,
and
I know like, that. Yeah.
You guys are working against me here. This is like, how do I survive? I noticed that the first iterations of gluten-free bread that we got out here, I don't know if they were adding sugar or adding a ton of fat or what it was, but it was like 200, 250 calories a slice. And mm-hmm. So I would just go like, well, everything is gluten-free, so it's fine. As long as I'm not eating gluten, I'll lose weight. And I was still gaining weight.
Yeah.
So the first time somebody said they had a keto bagel, it was like pork rinds, almond flour, heavy cream, mm-hmm. and cream cheese. And I was just like, you know, that doesn't sound healthy to me. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. There's a lot of dirty keto stuff out there. And you're right. People, just because it's gluten-free, just because it's keto, doesn't necessarily mean it's healthy. It's just maybe a better alternative for some people, but it's definitely something to depend on as your foundation of your meal.
Yeah. And by the way, that's not to say, I know people with celiacs, like you eat, that person eats gluten. It hits them. Yeah. It's not good. And my wife has RA. She has immediate responses to things like gluten.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to eat too much of it. And so that's my issue with it. Mm-hmm. But if I'm, you know, in this space that I'm in right now, I can make myself a sandwich on 647 bread and it has no effect on me other than the feeling of eating a sandwich makes me feel emotionally better for a moment and mm-hmm. gets me through whatever hurdle I'm experiencing on a severe cut.
Right. Well said. We're all different. Something that I know that you do that I talk to my patients about, and we kind of have to meet them where they're at. Not everybody's up for that. It overwhelms people, but it's concept of food prep. And do you still food prep now? And how much of it is a ingredient to your success as far as your weight loss and health goals?
I still food prep.
Okay.
I don't do so much food prep like for the week today as much as I do a day's food prep. Like I'll food prep for tomorrow or I get up early and food prep for the day. I just noticed that if I go to the grocery store hungry, I make bad decisions. And mm-hmm. if I decide that I'm going to eat a certain way tomorrow, but I don't have the food yet. Mm-hmm. It doesn't always work out. And it used to be that if I ran out on Wednesday, then Thursday I was throwing my hands up and, you know, eating whatever. And, mm-hmm. and it was kind of derailing me. You know, I think about starting a diet and I think, you know, the different definitions of diet, one is like restricting your food intake and the other is just the way you eat. Mm-hmm. So anytime I'm going to change the way I eat or just like it's Monday and I have more stuff to do this week than I did on Saturday and Sunday, Saturday I can wake up and as long as the food is in the house, I'm not going to have a problem. Mm-hmm. Monday is a different story. And so I want to make sure that I have everything I need and it's as ready as it has to be. So I've mm-hmm. done like, you know, when I was eating keto, the thing I loved about keto, especially dirty keto, is like you can get a meal at a 7-Eleven, you know?
Yeah.
That said, I still, you know, if I ate that meal today, I would probably get diarrhea like immediately and not feel great.
Right.
Clean keto is easier to do and eat really than I eat now, where stuff is kind of more portioned out in specific ways. Mm-hmm. It's not really hard and I don't need like a food scale to do it, but I need the types of foods. I can go get on a plane and rip turkey meat off a sandwich. Every airport I've been in has a pre-made turkey sandwich. And if you're lucky, they have a Togo's or a Jersey Mike's or something. And then you just get a pound of turkey meat. They'll sell that to you. Mm-hmm. That's pretty easy. Mm-hmm. It's not as easy as carrying, having my food in little containers. Mm-hmm. I'm blanking on what they're called, Tupperware containers. Yeah. And I just have a bag of food and, you know, my wife and kids may get embarrassed by it, but this is what I do. You know, it makes me happy. They can run around the airport and overpay for food if they want to.
That's what we do too. I mean, it is kind of, people stare, but when we open up the Tupperware, eat a glass Tupperware, and my wife will make some like egg salad or something like that. And there's almond flour crackers. It kind of smells the plane up a little bit, but it's like, hey,
this is what, man.
This is my, I'm not going to change the way that I eat and be subject to what the airport tells me I can eat.
Me neither.
Yeah.
I mean, they definitely don't have your best interests at heart.
Yeah. No. And you have to be proactive and plan this. I'm surprised that you haven't experimented with fasting yet, even like light fasting.
No, I haven't done that.
You try that. I'm curious to see what you'd like it, if you'd like it or not.
I want to try that. Oddly enough, some of my younger kids, like I have, my youngest is 13, and every now and again, she'll hit me with like, I'm a vegan now, Dad. And I'm like, okay. And then I'll see her eating bacon. And I say, I'm pretty sure that's not vegan. And she kind of realizes, but she woke up one day and was like, I'm going to just fast. And I said, okay. And she actually enjoys doing it. Something odd that happens with me is because I've been in rehab a few times and because I've quit doing drugs many times outside of rehab also. And I know the feeling of withdrawal and all of that. Almost every time I start a diet, I have that gloomy feeling, which is associated with, or to me, of when I have physical feelings, because I'm depriving myself of something. The hardest thing this year, I did a photo shoot in October and it's the first time I took my shirt off and I did a real awesome cut right up to it. Now, when I'm cutting food now, it's so light because I'm really only trying to lose 0.5 to 1% of my body weight per week. So it's really, really gentle. The hardest part was the last week when the guy who worked with me on it started messing with my salt and I started reducing my salt intake. And I felt that physically. And suddenly all my experiences in rehab crashed down upon me and I just, you know, feel awful. I think with fasting, because I oddly experienced that every time I started a really severely restrictive diet, or I do something like cut out salt or ancillary supplementary salt, that I have this feeling. And so the idea of, you know, and I know that once I was accustomed to it, it would be fine, but I think there would be the period of adjustment where I'd have to really push through that. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how long it'd take, a week, maybe 2 weeks before it was just like, this is now how I'm eating. And, you know, once your body, I think, has those cues, it's not going to tell you, you need to eat, unless you really do need to eat for some reason.
Right.
But I don't have, you know, low blood sugar issues or anything like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Well, we'll talk about it. I'm going to do a fasting challenge with you when you're up for it.
Yeah. Okay.
I heard that you are a fan of LaCroix, the drinks.
I love LaCroix.
Yeah.
Are you going to tell me how bad they are?
No. I love them. I love the LaCroix. So I want to know your favorite LaCroix flavor. What, if you had to pick, Please tell me it's Pamplemousse. Please.
Yeah.
Me.
Okay. That's the one.
All right. So
yeah.
I
saw the word Pamplemousse in my head and I'm never sure how to pronounce it, but
I don't even know if that's how you say it. I'm just saying it's grapefruit.
No,
it's grapefruit.
Yeah. That's what I was, like, it's grapefruit, right? It's not lemon. No, it's grapefruit, Pamplemousse. And I was trying. Yeah.
All right. For sure. Good. I knew that I loved you. So if you had to say what's your least favorite LaCroix?
Like, are you for sure? It's the coconut one.
Yes,
garbage. It's garbage.
Some people on my team love it. I'm like, no, this is junk. That's exactly my least favorite too.
Tastes like perfume to me. Yeah. By the way, I have, you know, with four kids, a case of LaCroix is gone in a day.
Yeah,
like it doesn't even last a day.
Yeah,
and then there's one kid who loves coconut, which I'm always more than happy to buy because I know it'll last forever because there's only one person drinking it. And like, she's not going to then drink, because she will drink Pamplemousse if there's no coconut.
That's hysterical. And I also heard that you liked the Spindrifts. So I'm a fan of those too.
I've got a blackberry.
Blackberry. I love that one.
Spindrifts right now. Fantastic.
The grapefruit Spindrifts are my favorite too. They're really good.
Yeah. Grapefruit's awesome, and I like lemon too. Lemon is good. Yeah. Spindrift's great.
Yeah, good stuff. Target, that's where I get mine. So one more last question before we go is, I'm curious, through your experience, I know everybody's different, but out of diet, like food and working out, which I know you work out amazingly quite a bit too, out of those two, like what was the biggest game changer, needle mover for you, or is it about even?
No, it's all diet, I think.
Okay.
Listen, I guess it depends. Right now, today, I am concerned with my muscles. And so I really am investing in, not even honestly, I haven't even done a massing phase. I've never done that. I mean, the version of a massing phase I do is I go, I'm not dieting for a year and I'm going to eat whatever I want. That's what I've done. And I gain 150 pounds. That's not a real massing phase. Mm-hmm. So I have either been, you know, cutting or maintaining my weight for a couple of years now on this program that I'm on. And I am super concerned with maintaining my muscle. So I work out very specifically to do that. But I come from, weight loss is my number one objective. And for the last almost 20 years, that is all diet.
Mm.
From what I've experienced, even I got obsessed with cycling, and even that I was starving myself to lose weight while riding a bike 8 hours a day. So I really do think it's, you know, I mean, I'm not going to say that that I think it's a good idea to be utterly sedentary, but I think you could be utterly sedentary and have a weight loss goal come to fruition by changing your diet.
Mm-hmm. Well said. And American Glutton, I need to talk about this before we go. It's one of the best titles of a podcast out there, and it's a huge favorite here at the clinics, huge fans here. How did that come about, and how did you get that great name for a podcast?
I had a couple buddies who do podcasts who were asking me to do podcasts. Now, this comes about mostly because of political or philosophical arguments I've had with my friends. And they're like, you should just go talk about this. Now, and I say, I don't actually believe any of this. I'm just enjoying having this argument.
Mm-hmm.
If I take this position publicly, that kind of sets me in stone as this thing. And that this thing is not something I'm even really in agreement with. Politically, I think it's all just a bunch of criminals for the most part. And then occasionally there's an honest guy who's like trying to play the criminal game. And so I don't even know if that's a safe thing to say right now. But my friends were asking me to do it. And I was like, I'm not going to do that. It's too, like, I don't care enough about politics. I just like arguing with you guys because you're my friends and it's safe to argue with you.
Yeah.
And then I woke up one day and went, well, I've been dieting for 20 years and I'm at a good place and I'd love to talk about that. And I'm really interested in guys like you and what you have to say. And want to have conversations with you. And the idea that I get an hour of free time with you, that I don't have to pay you to have this conversation, but that's huge for me. And so I said to my buddy who was opening a podcast studio, like, hey, I would do this. And he was not even super thrilled about it, but because he really wanted me to be controversial and talk about, you know, philosophy and politics, which I'm just not interested in doing. So that was how the podcast started. And the name was, I knew I wanted the word glutton because I so associate with that as my, as the deadly sin that that I could attribute a lot of my life to, spending time in that area of gluttony. And then I had some words before glutton, which people said, no, that's way too controversial. You cannot use that word. Like at one point I was going to call it anorexic glutton. And my wife was like, but what are you talking about? You're not anorexic. And I was like, I know, it just kind of sounds cool. And she was like, but that's a real problem people have. You can't say that. And I was like, oh, you're right. I'm sorry. I wasn't being mean.
Right.
And so at some point it was just like, oh, well, I'm American. I'm a glutton. I think a lot of people could relate to this idea. Let's talk about it.
I love it. It's a great show. Man, I could talk to you all day long. Thanks for talking with me.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Such an awesome human being. If you want to learn more about all the things that Ethan Suplee is working on, check it out at AmericanGlutton.net and be sure to check out his podcast, American Glutton. At the end of every episode, I'll be answering a question from one of you guys. Nothing is off limits. Ask me anything. And you can send your questions over to me on Instagram or Facebook. As a functional medicine practitioner, it's been fun seeing the questions that have already come in on different food philosophies, wellness trends, and ways to approach overall mental, emotional, and physical health and well-being. Thanks for those. And I'm looking forward to seeing what else is on your mind. Now it's time for another Ask Me Anything. Today's question is from Samantha. Samantha asks, hi, Dr. Cole. I heard that there are certain nutrient deficiencies that can drive fatigue. I'm really struggling with low energy and chronic fatigue symptoms. Is it true that there could be nutrient deficiencies that are making me feel so tired? Great question, Samantha. Let's go over it. There are many possible reasons why somebody could be struggling with low energy, fatigue. And look, I mean, chronic fatigue syndrome, CFS, is an actual diagnostic code. It's someone being labeled diagnostically. And even then, I mean, if someone's diagnosed with CFS, chronic fatigue syndrome, it just tells us how they feel. It's not actually saying why they have chronic fatigue in the first place. I mean, anybody that's diagnosed with chronic fatigue is going to say, yeah, I already know I'm chronically fatigued, but why the heck am I tired all the time? So it's my job as a functional medicine practitioner is diagnostically say, okay, that chronic fatigue is the check engine light on in the car, but why the heck is it on in the first place? And figure it out. And there's a lot of possible variables that are at play. It's typically a confluence of factors, a perfect storm of different variables that are at play that drive something like chronic fatigue syndrome or that larger fatigue spectrum. It may not be full-blown chronic fatigue syndrome, but it's somewhere on that low energy fatigue spectrum from mild fatigue or dips in energy all the way to CFS. So it's my job to say, no matter where you're at on that specific spoke of that inflammation spectrum, is to understanding the combination of variables that are at play. So nutrient deficiencies, which is what your question was referencing, Samantha, is one of many different things to consider. It's not just about nutrient deficiencies. Let me be very clear on that. We have to look at different chronic infections. We have to look at hormonal imbalances. We have to look at trauma, and we have to look at sleep disorders. We have to look at a lot of different things, different inflammatory cascades, underlying gut issues. I mean, I can go on and on of the things that are popping up in my mind, of things that I see on an hourly basis when I'm consulting patients online. But to keep it more succinct to your question, Samantha, let's talk about some of the nutrient deficiencies that I see at least playing as a component into why somebody feels the way that they do. It may not be the totality of why they have fatigue, but it's definitely contributing to it. It's definitely a piece of their fatigue puzzle. Number one is low iron. That's probably one of the most common things that I see, is low iron being a contributor or a bigger piece of the puzzle for them, if not fully what's going on. Iron deficiency anemia, IDA, or just low-grade iron deficiency can definitely be a part of that. And I would say too, specifically ferritin, which is a biomarker for stored iron, I see low ferritin very commonly as being a piece of their fatigue puzzle. So in functional medicine, we want ferritin to be at least 80. 50 is the lower limit of what's optimal, but 80 would be ideal for most people for optimal hormonal health and brain health and oxygenation of every cell of our body to have proper ATP and energy production. So I see many people that have slightly lower ferritin or extremely low ferritin, and it's being missed for years on conventional labs. It's either not ran or is ran. It's really not talked about or even addressed. So definitely want to look at ferritin levels, and that's something that we run as a standard lab for patients at the Functional Medicine Telehealth Center. And another nutrient deficiency that we see oftentimes is a magnesium deficiency. Magnesium is responsible for over 200 different pathways, largely governing energy production, brain health, hormone health. I see magnesium deficiency in so many people. So ferritin or iron deficiency, magnesium deficiency, and vitamin D deficiency would be the next one that comes to mind. Vitamin D is responsible for thousands of different pathways in the body, really governing energy production. It acts as almost a pro-hormone. Every cell of your body has a vitamin D receptor site. It's very much responsible for regulating inflammatory pathways. The brain is rich with vitamin D receptor sites. It's super important for so many things. In functional medicine, we want vitamin D to be at least 60, but really 60 to 80, and even higher than 80. For some people with autoimmunity, tend to do better with slightly higher vitamin D levels. And then on that point too, vitamin K2, which is another fat-soluble vitamin alongside with vitamin D that I see deficient in many people with fatigue issues or low energy, brain fog. So definitely vitamin D, and then B vitamins would be another thing that comes to mind. So folate, B12, very important. And people are just not eating nutrient dense food. So they're deficient in things and all of this stuff, iron, magnesium, vitamin D, vitamin K2, and with B vitamins. So certainly you can look at blood labs to get a snapshot in time on what that looks like, but it's definitely important to determine that, because why? These nutrients are raw materials for energy production. So it's definitely important. And it's also, I want to clarify here, this term that we use in functional medicine or health or wellness, or people just use it, is this term brain fog, which isn't always directly proportional, I find clinically, to fatigue. I see most people describe brain fog and fatigue as two separate phenomenons in their body, is that even when they have great energy days, they still can have that brain fog type symptoms, the word recall issues or the name recall issues, or people will say, I feel kind of hungover when they're not actually hungover, or they feel just like spacey, or they feel like when they walk into a room, they can't remember why they walked into the room or what they came into the room for. So these brain fog symptoms can be a part of fatigue. Obviously, the more fatigued somebody is, you'll see typically brain fog be exacerbated and amplified and aggravated, but not necessarily true all the time. They're not always directly proportional. So it's important to really, I mean, for me as a clinician, to really listen to the person and hear what their experience is and validate what they're going through and understand it and investigate why they're going through what they're going through. So a lot of these nutrient deficiencies could play a role in brain fog symptoms too, or neuroinflammation or brain inflammation specifically, that could be driving some of their cognitive symptoms as well. Great question, Samantha. I hope it helped. That's it for today. Thanks again for hanging out with me. I would love to know what you think about the art of being well. If you have a chance, please rate and review the podcast here. And if you like what you're hearing, hit subscribe and pass it along to a friend. To see more, head to drwillcole.com/podcast. I'll be back again next Thursday, and I hope you will too. Talk soon.